Welcome to a special hour-long episode of Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm joined today by an author and curator whose works include It's Life as I See It, Black Cartoonists in Chicago, 1940 to 1980, the collected Harry Who publications, and Crumb, A Cartoonist's Life. He's a co-curator for the Whitney Museum exhibition 60s Surreal and curator at large for the Lucas Museum of Narrative Art. Dan Nadel, it's a pleasure to have you on Words and Pictures.
Thanks so much for having me. Happy to be here virtually.
Very happy as well. So Dan, you have a deep and abiding fascination with outsider art and underground comics. Where did all of this start for you?
It started for me at a convenience store on River Road in suburban Washington, D.C. I got completely fascinated by comic books as a kid and pretty quickly learned that I could learn a ton more about them in a library, the Bethesda Public Library. And so I was a history-minded kid, and I spent a huge amount of time digging into the history of comics at the library. And there were some great books that were available in the, I guess this was the early, mid-80s. And there was the Smithsonian Book of American Comics. There was one of comic books, and there were a few histories. And it just, it's one of those things where you have an interest because it just clicks. It sort of tickles the right part of your brain. And in my case, it really did. It turned into a really long-lasting fascination.
Well, I'm holding on to this 450-page book of yours, Crumb, A Cartoonist's Life. The subject of the book is an artist who's been in the public eye, whether he likes it or not, for more than half a century.
Yes, indeed. I mean, Robert really burst onto the scene around 1968. Early 1968 is when it really kind of took off with the publication of Zap Comics in February of that year. But what's interesting is that he'd sort of been in the public consciousness for a few years already through his work in greeting cards and underground newspapers. So it was a slow build, but by the middle of 68, with the release of Cheap Thrills, Big Brother and the Holding Company's record Cheap Thrills with Janis Joplin as the singer, that album art combined with Robert's publications of Zap 1 and 2, suddenly he was sort of hitting all registers of the American consciousness. It was, you know, on stereos and suburbia all over the place and in head shops. And then by 69, he's in museums. So it's suddenly kind of hitting all the quadrants possible.
Well, I think that many of our listeners got their introduction to Robert Crumb, R. Crumb, in the 1994 documentary by Terry Zwigoff, which was simply called Crumb. For anybody whose curiosity was piqued by that film, your book takes a much, much deeper dive into the background and long, varied career of Robert Crumb.
Yeah, it does. I love that film. It's very much a family portrait, and a portrait of Crumb also, the sort of provocateur. This is a book that attempts to ground Robert in a larger cultural context, whether it's the history of comics or the history of graphic satire or the history of comedy or where he lands in the larger mix of 20th century and 21st century art. You know, the nice thing about Crumb is you don't need any of this to appreciate the work. But if you want to understand the scope of his achievement, if you want to understand what his influence has been and where he came from, I think this book does a lot to get you there. You know, if you want to understand the real lineage of cartooning, it feeds into him and the lineages of cartooning that come out of him. That's really a big part of the book, as well as understanding the nuts and bolts of what it is he does. You know, what is it to make a line on a paper, and what are the tools necessary? I mean, that's in there. And I wanted to really allow texture and nuance into a subject that is often kind of caricatured.
Yeah, well, Crumb himself, you mentioned his growing up in America and his battle with the hucksterism and self-promotion that's just part of American society. He is, to put it mildly, not a public-facing figure. He's not an extrovert. It sounds like it was your long career as a curator and a chronicler of outsider art that led Robert Crumb to trust you to tell his story, this voluminous story.
Thanks. Yeah, I would say, he'd been contacted by a number of different biographers over the years, and what he told me is the reason he allowed me to do this is because he wouldn't have to explain the comics context to me. That, I knew all that stuff already, and so I was coming to it with a pretty deep knowledge of that history and of the aesthetic currents embedded in it. So, I think his big concern was having to babysit someone as they learned the history that he was so much a part of, and also the history that he sort of made. And yeah, he didn't have to do that with me.
Well, you make an interesting claim in the beginning of the book. There's really a number of pioneers of underground comics, the 1960s, people like Bill Griffith, Gilbert Shelton, Trina
Sure.
Robbins. But you make the case that Robert Crumb had the most lasting impact on the medium. At the beginning of the book, you write about Crumb, quote, "If his urgent message hadn't found its moments, today's landscape of best-selling graphic novels would be impossible. There is no Mouse, no Persepolis, no Fun Home without his taboo-breaking, beautifully drawn, and formally inventive work."
I'll stand by that. Absolutely. I mean, my feeling is yes, obviously Bill Griffith is great, Kim Deitch is great, Aileen Kaminsky Crumb is amazing, Spiegelman, all these people. But Robert was the first person to, well, let me back up. It's one thing to treat comics, as Jules Feiffer did, for example, as a place for sophisticated themes and philosophical ruminations. That was going. But what Robert did is take the comic book as an object and as a container and use that to tell not just sophisticated stories about philosophical or sociological quandaries, as Pfeiffer did, but to crack it wide open to hold any kind of content he could imagine. And to do so in its native language. So that is the sort of fundamental achievement. And without him being able to, in a single comic, do, a sort of surrealist poetry romp like Meatball, or a sort of essayistic piece like City of the Future, or funny satire like Mr. Natural, and also do fairly sexually explicit material about the nature of the id. Doing all of that at once kind of sets a whole new level for what cartoonists could tackle in the future. It's not just that he did one thing or another, tackled one theme or another. It's that he tackled all the themes. And by, really by the end of 69, he's covered so much territory that, yeah, I think there really isn't anyone who pointed in so many directions all at once. You could follow his lead with essayistic comics. You could follow his lead with stoner funnies. You could follow his lead with kind of surrealist poetry. You could follow his lead with autobiography. There were just so many avenues. And that really did change everything. And also that there were no boundaries. Pfeiffer still had to be polite. It still had to sort of pass. Well, just pass. It had to pass. But Crumb didn't have to be polite, and he wasn't. And so I think a certain amount of that vulgarity and heedlessness about what cultural norms might be opened the door to so many people. There isn't that kind of versatile adult graphic novel world without him, for sure.
That boundary pushing you talk about, that started early. And in the book, you talk about the Crumb family and especially Robert's older brother Charles, how obsessed the two of them were with comics, especially funny animal comics. Yeah, the Carl Barks Donald Duck, Walt Kelly's Pogo. They had no use for superhero comics. They thought those were horrible in the same way that Chris Ware thinks that Superman is a horrible figure. And this was also Charles Crumb before the sort of burned out husk you see in the Terry Zwigoff film. This was a very culturally aware older brother. And so the two of them were just churning out these comics and pushing boundaries, trying out autobiographical work, veering into philosophy and history. And at an early age, they were even trying to put their work out there into the wider world.
It's interesting. They were pushing really hard just for themselves. And I think what happened eventually is they were doing these comics that were takeoffs on Treasure Island, for example, but also two-man comics where each would draw dialogue and their own characters interacting with one another as a way of communication, as a way of getting to each other. But also in Crumb's case, sort of drawing his own sad sack existence as a teenager. But eventually, I think Robert, unlike Charles, really wanted to get out in the world. As reticent as Robert can be or was, there was a drive to get published, to be seen in a way that I don't think Charles really had. I think Charles was ultimately inward. It was about the activity, not so much the final product. And with Robert, it's much more, yes, the activity, but also here it is. Here's the thing itself. And that's a different instinct. I think that is also a survival instinct of sort of wanting to make this into a viable way of living.
You're listening to a special hour-long episode of Words and Pictures. I'm your host, SW Concer, and I'm talking today with Dan Nadel. He's the curator at large for the Lucas Museum of Narrative Art and the author of Crumb, A Cartoonist's Life. Before we get back to the conversation, I'd like to take a moment to remind our listeners that KBOO is in the last week of our All Thrills, No Frills membership drive. We hope that you've been enjoying our programming and that you'll take a moment to pledge your support. There are all kinds of ways to join KBOO. On the web, you can visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. And if you prefer to go analog, we're always happy to receive a contribution in the mail. The address of the station is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And now let's talk some more with our guest, Dan Nadel. But you write about Robert leaving home, and it was not a happy home when he left and moved out and started working as a teenage greeting card drone at the time, sort of working a printing job at American Greetings. But you write that Robert has always known he could have shared Charles's fate. Charles gave him a way to get through life and then just withdrew. Charles stayed behind. Robert went out into the world and tempted fate.
I think he, by the time he left, he was already seeing Charles decline. And that made him aware of what could await him if he just stayed and languished. The conversation around mental illness and things like that was so different in the early 1960s and late 1950s that there was language around this stuff, especially for, I should say, for those guys, there wasn't language around this stuff. And Robert had the energy to leave and the interest to leave. Charles just didn't, And it's one of the enormous differences between these two artists that Robert wanted to get out in the world. in a way that was, while he was anxious and fearful about it, that didn't stop him from doing it and then continuing to do it. It wasn't like he went to Cleveland and stayed in Cleveland, or went to Cleveland and came back home. It was a continuous need to keep pushing out.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about influences. You mentioned Art Spiegelman earlier. One of the things that Crumb shares with Art Spiegelman, the author of Mouse, is the huge influence that Mad Comics and later Mad Magazine had on them in the 1950s.
Yes, absolutely. It's so hard to imagine now something as simple as a magazine landing with that kind of enormous, it's like a comet hitting the earth. And it's hard to explain, and even for me, hard to understand how something like that could have that kind of seismic impact. But Mad, which was, the creation of a guy named Harvey Kurtzman, who was a Jewish kid from New York City, and very good friends with another Jewish kid named Will Elder, and Al Jaffe, of course, came later, Wally Wood. But essentially, what Kurtzman put together was a comic book initially that just ruthlessly satirized all of the culture and norms that kids and adults were consuming at that point. And this was a time in the early 1950s when everything was supposed to be good and okay. The GIs had come home. There was a sort of new emergent suburbia. There was enormous prosperity, supposedly. And everything was supposed to be hunky-dory. And Mad kind of drops into this with this completely contemptuous gaze at the culture, but funny, not contemptuous and sour, contemptuous and wry and funny and riotous. I think it probably was effective in some ways because the spirit of it is so much about laughter. And yes, you could say all these things that Superman was a creep and you could make fun of Marlon Brando and all this sort of stuff, but it was all for laughs. And that goes a long way. I mean, if you're an alienated kid or adult and you see something, yeah, you can like latch on to the downers, or you can latch on to something that skewers and enlightens, but also makes you laugh. And it's a sort of a positive thing. I think so, that's one of the reasons it was so influential, is it pointed to other possibilities and other ways of looking at things. And it helped that it was very much a Jewish sensibility. I mean, it was really a Yiddishkeit sensibility of absurdity, uproarious laughter. Nothing is sacred. And also, as Will Elder would say, the schmaltz, the chicken fat that was packed into those pages. And what he meant was endless amounts of incidental drawings in each panel. So if you have a panel of Superman, Super Duper Man, as they said, or Starchy, which is Archie, it wasn't just that character in a panel with a sidewalk. It was that character and a zillion other little doodles and happenings all around him. So that
Little handbills on the
this,
fence and
handbills that changed, and absolutely all that stuff. For that whole generation, it was just it was truth to power and a sort of crack in the facade of everything is hunky dory, and also a particularly ethnic crack at a time that was very lily white.
yeah, I guess if you want to get mythical or archetypal, you could talk about trickster energy. You could talk about the coyote figure, or Till Eulenspiegel, or Bugs Bunny, or whatever,
Absolutely.
that shape-shifting energy that just makes a prank of things and then disappears.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think that's very fair.
Well, you're talking about Harvey Kurtzman, and after Mad, he started a couple of other magazines like Humbug and Help. And when Crumb and Spiegelman were both starting out, Harvey Kurtzman took them under his wing. Crumb submitted work to Kurtzman's magazine Help, which is where he was introduced to artists like Jay Lynch, Gilbert Shelton, and Terry Gilliam.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Help. Kurtzman had a really interesting sort of checkered post-Mad career. And this would have been the third place he landed. was Help, which was a satire magazine started in the early 1960s and only lasted until 65, in which he brought on new talent and was really, I mean, he was always very open to new talent. He had a great eye for talent. And Help was a pretty funny magazine that indeed had like the young Terry Gilliam working for it. Gloria Steinem was the secretary. I mean, it's kind of a fun who's who. You know, Mort Saul was on the cover, Jonathan Winters, all sorts of people. And Robert submitted a comic and then came to New York and did a sketchbook report for Kurtzman and ultimately was asked to join the staff. The trick being that when he arrived in New York, you know, apartment rented and with his wife, he got to the Help offices on a Monday morning and the whole magazine was closing down. So he had arrived just in time for it all to be over. And that was actually the last magazine that Kurtzman ran. That was it. That was the end. But he was very kind to Crumb, Kurtzman. He always tried to look out for him and hook him up with jobs, which he did in New York. I mean, he helped Robert hook up with Topps Bubblegum, where he drew monster cards. They were called monster greetings, these cards, and just generally get work. But yeah, it was tough timing, and Help had been a wonderful incubator for the nascent underground, basically.
And Kurtzman later got frustrated with Crumb. I think this might have been, based on Kurtzman's feeling tenuous about his own career, but he kind of thought Crumb was allergic to success when he was publishing all these different underground comics instead of sticking with one popular title like
Sure.
Zap.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Kurtzman's diagnosis is not too far off the mark, but I think it's also a fundamental misunderstanding of what an understandable misunderstanding of what Crumb was all about, which was he had watched his heroes have single titles for a long time, and he didn't want to do that. He thought maybe some of them got stale, some of them got into a rut. He really wanted to keep himself fresh. And he loved the idea of the sort of newsstand of the mind, this idea that he could populate a whole shelf of comics with all different titles, all different logos. It would be his almost like a human publishing machine. And that is a whole other way of thinking about the medium. It's not thinking about continuing characters. It's not thinking about continuing titles. It's thinking about it as a place in which you could just do anything you wanted. So why would you tether yourself to something if you could actually start a new title the next day, start a new theme, think of it in a whole other manner. It's just it's a different thing. It's a different mentality towards the medium and also just to work in general.
Yeah, well, Crumb definitely had a number of comics that were just drawn and written by himself alone, but he also worked on anthology comics. I mean, Zap was an early anthology comic, and later there
Sure.
was Arcade and Weirdo. They seem to have been inspired in part by Kurtzman, by his work at Mad and Help, bringing all these different artists together.
Oh yeah, for sure. I think it inspired by a few things. One is Robert for years has loved, like Kurtzman, and he shares this with Kurtzman, he has a great eye for talent and is very encouraging of other cartoonists, of cartoonists he thinks are authentic and dedicated. And so that's one piece of it. Another piece of it is, admiring Kurtzman's Mad and Humbug and Help and wanting to sort of try his hand at that aspect of it. But the other part of it is I think he likes the idea of fostering something larger than himself. So in the case of Zap, it started as his own comic, but when he saw that there were like-minded artists out there, which he saw very quickly, he thought, well, why not bring them in and make this a group and sort of have a movement almost, find company. And in the case of Weirdo, a little later, it was really about, again, kind of trying to put forward a, if not a way of thinking about the medium, his way of thinking about the medium and his way of thinking about what a magazine could contain.
I want to backtrack a little bit, go back to Crumb's teenage days, when he and his brother Charles were influenced by Mad, and Mad Magazine, Mad Comics, and Mad Magazine inspired a cottage industry of comics fanzines. And Robert and Charles jumped into that scene along with a schoolmate, Mike Britt.
Yep, Mike Britt, Portland local. Yes, indeed. I think that was a whole world at the time that was so important because it was a moment when Mad was over. It started out based around Humbug, basically, but this was a moment when how would anyone know that there were other people in the country that were interested in this stuff? You know, you meet somebody in school, like Crumb met Mike, and you form a friendship around these shared interests, but then how are you to know that this is a larger thing? And it was Mike who spotted an ad in an issue of Humbug that was advertising, or not an ad, it was a letter saying that there was this zine available, a fanzine available that was about Humbug. And then Mike sent away for it and it came, and they all realized that there was this network of fans, or at least another fan. But that fanzine mentioned other fanzines. So suddenly you realize that there's this world out there and it exists through the exchange of mimeographed fanzines. And that was really their first experiment in publishing. It was a fanzine called Foo that was basically a place for them to try out their own Mad or EC like comics and send it around to friends and sell it and see what would happen. It was their first publishing venture.
You're listening to a special hour-long episode of Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and I'm talking today with writer and curator Dan Nadel. He's the curator at large for the Lucas Museum of Narrative Art and the author of numerous books, including Art Out of Time, Unknown Comics Visionaries 1900 to 1969, and Crumb, A Cartoonist's Life. Before we get back to the conversation, I'd like to take a moment to remind our listeners that KBOO is in the last week of our All Thrills, No Frills membership drive. We hope that you've been enjoying our programming and that you'll take a moment to pledge your support. KBOO is one of the very last media outlets that still brings you local and independent news, music, and public affairs. We've been doing this here in Portland for over half a century, and this program has been coming to you for 20 years now, inviting important cultural figures into the studio and venturing out to events that might fly beneath the radar of the big media monoliths. So yes, you can support this very special programming today by going online to kboo.fm/give, or simply text KBOO to 44321. And if you prefer to go analog, we're always happy to receive a contribution in the mail. The address of the station is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And now let's talk some more with our guest, Dan Nadel. So this was the start of a teenage Crumb finding out about the outside world. And along the way, there was another mentor that came along. He was a slightly older college student. His name was Marty Powles. He became an in-law later, but we won't. But Marty was the one who nurtured Robert's interest in American literature and history and roots music.
I mean, Marty was somebody that they met through fandom, and a super interesting guy from Ohio who was going to Kent State in the early 1960s, late 1950s, early 1960s, and became this sort of best friend to Robert for many, many years, and really his first chronicler. I mean, his first biographer, Marty was a writer and a collector, of course, and helped bring Robert along in everything from literature, from like book recommendations to records to certain comics. And ultimately, when Robert needed someone to go to get away from home, it was to Cleveland and Marty that he went as a 19-year-old, in 1962. So Marty really played an enormous role in his life. Also, just showing him what a life outside of home might look like, for better or for worse. In the 60s in particular, played a really important role in being an audience for Robert, but also an encouraging force for his artwork and a sort of real, a real belief in Robert's abilities.
Well, Marty dragged Robert out of his shell in so many ways. I mean, he not only just overtly offered, the newly graduated from high school Robert a place to stay in Cleveland, but he introduced him to coffee house culture, the whole bohemian lifestyle of
Sure.
the early 60s. He actually introduced Robert to his first wife, but this was the time when Robert got his first art gig. And at first, it wasn't really an art gig. It was sort of a production gig at American Greetings. But he got discovered just on the strength of his doodles.
Yeah.
And he got promoted to the highbrow department at American Greetings, where his boss was Tom Wilson, the Ziggy Comics artist.
Yes, later on, Tom Wilson created Ziggy. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's again, it's a testament to Robert's talent, but also his willingness to follow his talent. He was spotted by a guy named Ralph Schaefer, and who was an art director there at American Greetings, and then Tom Wilson gave him the nod. And Highbrow was essentially a In the 60s, greeting cards were really an enormous business. And American Greetings was just right after Hallmark as the most popular greeting card company in America. And the highbrow cards were sort of responding to this in the early 60s, still this sort of new bohemia emerging at the time. It was before hippie culture, but there was this sort of everybody knew that something was going on. So these cards were meant to appeal to a more sophisticated audience. And so the drawings would have a sort of spindly look, or a little shaggy around the edges. The writing would be a little risque sometimes.
Very much a wink and a nod in the writing of
Yeah,
these cards.
absolutely. Yeah, they were very meta. And I think, yeah, he wound up there, and it was extremely encouraging for him. I mean, he quickly, of course, saw the limits of it and wanted to get out, but it was certainly an enormous confidence booster. Him. And also a place where he learned how to make publishable artwork. He knew how then to prepare something for color separation and then to see it through press. And that became enormously helpful to him when he was essentially publishing himself in the late 60s. He knew how to be a professional.
And Tom Wilson, his boss, was always urging artists to make their characters cuter, which
That's right.
Crumb admits had a lifelong effect on his work.
Yeah, he says that. It's interesting. I think there's something to it. I think I tend to think he maybe exaggerates the real effect of that on him. But certainly by the time he's drawing Zap in 1967, you can see how the round cuteness of American Greetings had sort of infiltrated his drawing style. But I also think it was enormously helpful. I think that American Greetings sort of injected a slightly more commercial mainstream element into what he was up to. And that made it go over in an even bigger and sort of more clear way for a general audience that was intrigued by the stuff.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, is if you think that the cuteness in his 1960s work became a selling point, not just for his work, but for undergrounds in general.
Definitely. I think for his work in particular, I think that cuteness, that accessibility was enormously helpful in it. Because ultimately, if you see something the content of which might seem slightly off or risque or dangerous, but the form is familiar and safe, you're going to be okay. Well, I'll check it out, you know? And that had a huge influence on the look and feel of underground comics. I mean, so much of what underground comics became is formed around what Robert did, you know? All the different titles, all the different logos, that was very much him. And I think what you see is people trying to make things that are graphic and communicative.
Yeah, Crumb's first submission to Harvey Kurtzman's help was a Fritz the Cat comic. And Fritz the Cat, it was a character that goes all the way back to Crumb's teenage days, actually.
That's right.
It's maybe his most recognizable character of, aside from Mr. Natural. But yeah, he did this two-pager that was very cute and also obviously risque. And Harvey said, "I love the Pussycats. Publishing this might get me thrown in jail."
That's right. I know, because it was sort of it was Fritz the cat seducing, yeah, another cat and taking her clothes off. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a funny harbinger of what was to come. You know, that Robert was using these very cute characters to be kind of naughty and figuring, I think, that Help would maybe would go for it because Help was, you know, for adults essentially. But yeah, it's Fritz. Fritz became so iconic because it's playing with the classic thing of the cartoon cat, you know, Crazy Cat, Felix the Cat, and so many others. So it's using that iconography, but then pushing it into another realm.
So, Crumb has been courting controversy with his artwork from the start. And early on in the 1960s, the 70s, it was the right-wing censors that were cracking down on the head shops where Zap comics were sold, where the underground comics were
Sure.
sold. More recently, though, a younger generation has complained about the violent fantasy stories involving women or the stereotypical characters such as Angel Food, McDevil's Food.
Angel Food McSpade, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's every generation is going to handle this material differently. And I think that, well, what are you asking?
Well, you know, okay. I think in some way he was not just bringing up his personal id, as he sometimes would say, but also just the influences he grew up with. So I imagine that 1940s and 50s America had even more offensive pop culture images, especially in comics. So yeah, it's awkward, but it's understandable for Crumb to point to all of that and say, "This is what was taking up space in my brain, and I tried in some way to recontextualize it."
Yeah, I mean, I think that and there's a few things at play here. One is yes. Yes, he is pointing to this stuff and trying to figure it out for himself. He is not a sort of consciously analytical artist in the sense that it's not procedural. It's not as though he's saying, here's X and here's what I'm going to say about X and here's how. It's much more unconscious, which is, I think, why it pushes so many buttons. It's not neat or tidy. It is, yes, a critique. But also drawn by somebody who might be enjoying drawing that as well. I think it's fair to say that he's drawn a lot of extremely racist and sexist material, and that's what it is. But within those overarching umbrellas, you can pull out interesting things. You can point to the Angel Food McSpade and say, well, this can also be viewed as a critique of the white male fantasy of the sort of primal black goddess. You can look at it that way. And then you can also say, but Robert may have been getting off on drawing it as well. It's all double, triple, quadruple-edged swords, you know. And younger generations, I mean, the trick of this stuff is that detached from context, as so many things are, if you see a single panel of one of these comics, and that's all you know of the work, then sure, you're going to hate it. And I get that. But that is not how I think art should be consumed. And I think one of the mistakes is not treating this as ambitious, multi-layered art by an artist who is fallible and human. And so you have to sort of take a breath and realize that this is not a right-wing zealot doing it. This is a complicated person making complicated work. And if you want to engage with it, the way to engage with it is, yes, you could just push it to the side and say, forget it. That's everybody has the right to do that. I think where it gets tricky for people is that he does loom so large in comics and they get tired. And I understand it. Everybody gets tired of being told that someone is canonical all the time. Every generation wants to reinvent the canon for themselves, and they should.
Just going back to the Zweigoff film, to Crumb, I mean, the thing that in some ways sort of traumatized Robert to some extent Aileen was
Oh, yeah.
all of this mental illness that had really crumbled the rest of the family, like Charles, like his mother, like Maxon. And I hadn't heard this before, but you mentioned in the book that there were rumors that Robert's dad, Charles Sr., was a closeted gay man.
There was a rumor,
Yeah,
yeah. A rumor,
well,
yes.
much like Robert's older brother, Charles Jr.
Sure. Yeah.
And Robert always said that his father was the inspiration for this uptight recurring character in his comics, White Man.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure where you're going. Tell me
Well,
where you're going.
just that this sense of repression,
Oh, yeah.
obviously, I mean, clearly has been working its way through his comics for decades.
Yes, for sure. And I think he's been working it through for decades. It really burst out in the late 60s. And I think a lot of it is examining the sort of forces of repression around him, not just his father, but sort of society writ large. And it's been a recurring theme for him for many years. And lately, I think also has sort of softened into trying to understand it in a way that not just rage against it, but understand it. Which has been important. Yeah.
You're listening to a special hour-long episode of Words and Pictures. I'm your host, SW Konser, and I'm talking today with Dan Nadel. He's the curator at large for the Lucas Museum of Narrative Art and the author of Crumb, A Cartoonist's Life. Before we get back to the conversation, I'd like to take a moment to remind our listeners that KBOO is in the last week of our All Thrills, No Frills membership drive. We hope that you've been enjoying our programming and that you'll take a moment to pledge your support. There are all kinds of ways to join KBOO. On the web, you can visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. And if you prefer to go analog, we're always happy to receive a contribution in the mail. The address of the station is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And now let's talk some more with our guest, Dan Nadel. Well, Crumb himself has always expressed a longing for the past. Old movies and old music makes him wistful for a time when culture was not so commodified. And that goes back, to the early 60s when he was a teenager.
Sure. I mean, it is also a fantasy because, as he knows, and we know, culture has always been commodified, just to different degrees and different levels and different areas of awareness. I mean, the music he loves was recorded because it was meant to be sold. The movies he loves were enormous studio productions that were meant to generate income. So his vision of the past, as much as I love it, is as much of a fantasy as anything else. I'm not a big believer in sort of one version of authenticity over another. And he also is not as much in the past as he would tell you, or as you would see from the public-facing persona. I mean, this is somebody who, reads a lot of magazines and a lot of books and newspapers and keeps up and is engaged in the present.
So you're saying on one level it's a bit of a pose.
I wouldn't call it a pose so much as a rhetorical stance. I don't think he's being disingenuous. I just think that if you, that's the thing about writing this th sort of thing. Like, I can see how he's thinking about it, listen to how he's talking about it, read what he's written about it, and then kind of come to my own conclusions. So it's because the book isn't meant to parrot him. It's sort of my take, my sustained hot take, as the kids say.
It's funny to see photographs from the 1960s and 70s and all of these underground cartoonists at Rip Off Press or Last Gasp. They're all long-haired artists in tie-dye and bell bottoms. And then there's Crumb, who's always dressed like an old-world villager.
Yes, he's always dressed like a Depression era salesman. Yeah, great fashion sense. It's funny. The guy has a great sense of clothes. Yeah, he totally sticks out in those photos, which is hilarious and delightful. But to me, in some ways, his outfits seem timeless in a way everybody else's seem dated. But yeah, I mean, he's definitely a guy who prefers old things. Yes.
Well, in some way, his retro sensibility was way ahead of the curve. Like, as a teenager, he became a self-taught musicologist and collector. He looked for old 78 records in junk shops, even went door to door in African American neighborhoods. And Crumb, he became a big believer in making your own music. He got together with Robert
Oh, yeah.
Armstrong and Al Dodge and Terry Zwigoff to form the retro string band, the Cheap Suit Serenaders.
Absolutely. Yeah. The music thing started pretty early. He started playing the ukulele when he was young. And I think the music thing also, it provides a whole other source of pleasure and peace for him and his mind. And then the idea, so funny, like so many things with him, it sort of something begins as private and for himself and then becomes public. And in the case of the band, meeting Al Dodge and Bob Armstrong, these guys, and finding a sort of common musical language and a common visual language was really important to him because it took him out of the mix of the Zap guys, who were all much more macho and focused on the sort of go moment of underground comics and the counterculture. Bob and Al were different, a little more chill, and I think they liked the idea of playing out together, but like many things, as soon as you attach Crumb to it, it sort of becomes this larger thing. And that, of course, wears thin for Robert at a certain point when he's, when something becomes a job, he starts looking for the door,
We haven't talked enough about Aileen Kaminsky, who became Crumb's second wife and lifelong love. He lost her to cancer a few years ago, and she was a muse. Yeah, she was when they met, Aileen was an established cartoonist in her own right. Her style was sort of this Weimar Republic kind of look. Almost like a block print kind of look. And
Yeah, kind of art brute.
so before they moved to France, when they were still living in the Central Valley north of the Bay Area, they started another anthology magazine. It was called Weirdo, and Weirdo ran for 28 issues in the 1980s and early 90s. So it started out, Bob started as the editor for the first few issues. And then Peter Bagg of Hate Comics came in and edited several issues. And finally, Aileen was the editor for most of the last issues. And Aileen published the early work of some now celebrated women cartoonists, including Julie Doucet, Mary Fleener, Carol Tyler.
Great artists, all of them. Phoebe Gleckner, of course. Yeah, I mean, Weirdo is an incredible document. It was a truly amazing magazine. And Robert started it because he needed a way forward for comics. I think he had gotten to a point in the 70s where he really needed to figure out what he wanted to do with the medium. And he didn't want the pressure of carrying a title himself. So this was a way to embed his own work with people he felt a kinship with and to sort of put forward this vision. I think Peter Bagg comes in and is a younger generation, somebody who had, as a teenager, found Crumb. And so he brought in his cohort, which was, they were in their 20s in the 1980s, as opposed to the 1960s. When Aileen took over, she really focused on finding her own cohort. And she knew a lot of these women because she had pioneered a much darker brand of cartooning, a sort of, instead of uplift, like feminine uplift, it was much more about the difficulties of being a woman, both psychologically and physically, and self-esteem, and the pressures of men, and all this stuff, and told from her perspective, like real hardcore autobiography. That was enormously influential on people like Phoebe Gleckner and Julie Doucet and Carol Tyler, this sort of door that Aileen opened up. So it was only natural that when she took over the reins at Weirdo, that she would look for and cultivate these women as collaborators and contributors. So I think it's an incredible magazine that way, and something that has been well appreciated. There's a wonderful book by John Cook about Weirdo that is really invaluable. I think, Aileen was a wonderful, wonderful artist, just a lovely person to be around as well. And was I was lucky enough to spend time with her during this process, and she was great. She's, just a great person, great energy, and the level of work she was making was extremely high. And I think it is one of those things that's kind of going to be evergreen. Like, it's always going to be influential. Like, anybody that picks up that work, it kind of blows people's minds every time, I think, because it's very direct, it's very honest, and it's funny. Like the old Mads, she's not trying to drag you down. She's always going for a laugh, even if she's telling you the most painful things. It's quite an amazing balancing act, I must say. She was something. Great artist.
The artists who appeared in Weirdo, this was a very brave time to be an underground artist because it was the 80s. It was a real slack time for the alternative press. Free weeklies were about the only newspapers where comics were running, like Linda Barry's comic, Matt Groening's comic. But to actually do a magazine at this time was pretty brave. And it's interesting that Crumb and Spiegelman took different directions with their magazines. Weirdo, Crumb's magazine, was it was really on the level of Mad. It was, newsprint, it was cheap. Spiegelman with Raw was going for something that was much more slick and highbrow. So Peter Bagg talks about how Raw would be on the newsstands and Weirdo would be in the bargain bins.
I mean, it really is so much about the difference in their sensibilities, right? It's like, I love them both equally. I think they're both amazing. Art is a much more cosmopolitan guy who is also much more interested in all sorts of different kinds of avant-garde art in a way that Robert is not, and was also much more interested in innovating the formal structure of comics, as opposed to only, I mean, Robert did both form and content. Art took an almost like structuralist approach to comics and pulling it apart, putting it back together in different ways, and looking for artists who are equally interested in that kind of thing. And really interested in comics that were consciously literary, like Lorenzo Matotti or Jacques Loustal or Tardi, people that were working to make contemporary fiction in comics form, essentially. That wasn't where Robert's interests lay at the time. So each of them, kind of wonderfully, these two children of Harvey Kurtzman, really produced very, very different magazines, but both of which offered jumping off points and career starters for a couple generations of brilliant, deeply important cartoonists. I think they're fascinating, both of them.
Since Aileen's death, you write about what a comfort Sophie Crumb, their daughter, has been to Robert living nearby. And it's ironic because, the Crumbs, as well as Aileen's family, they were considered troubled families everywhere they
I
lived.
know. Isn't that funny?
There were rampant mental illness and addiction issues, and much of it was undiagnosed. So when Robert and Aileen were married and considering having a child, their therapist actually recommended against it.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, I think there is a certain irony here. Aileen, over the years, both in Winters, California, where they lived, and then in France, in the village where they are, really fostered a sense of community and family. It was extremely important to her to be a part of something and have a robust set of friends and people that she trusted. And both Aileen and Robert are extremely charismatic and draw people to them. So in a way, that's sort of their replacement for an extended family. But by the same token, they're extremely close to Sophie. And in these last couple of years since Aileen died, I mean, Sophie and her children have been extremely important to Robert, and as has the community that Aileen and Robert, but Aileen in particular, really nurtured over the years. They've been there, geez, over 30 years now. So it's a community of people that really loved her, love him, and have stepped up in a way that is quite moving and great comfort to him. Yes, absolutely. And he's doing, he's doing good. He's in New York right now, but he's working and he is playing music, and it's a all together a pretty good life.
You've been listening to a special hour-long episode of Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and my guest today has been Dan Nadel. He's the curator at large for the Lucas Museum of Narrative Art and the author of numerous books, including Crumb: A Cartoonist's Life. Dan, it's been a pleasure to talk with you today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
For our listeners who might be interested in your various projects, how can they find out more?
You can go to my website, dnadel.com, dnadel.com, or you can follow me on Instagram at dannadel.
And a note for listeners, Dan's book is out on bookshelves now, and he will be visiting Portland. You can see Dan in person next Tuesday at Powell's Books at Cedar Hills Crossing. That's April 22nd, 7 p.m. at Powell's Cedar Hills store. More info at powells.com. Well, we hope that everybody has been enjoying this special hour-long episode of Words and Pictures for KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills membership drive. Before we go, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that this community radio station needs your support. To become a member of KBOO or to arrange for a donation of any size, please visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. Or if you prefer, you can mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of the show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.